Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and this is the Editor's Roundtable. Today, I'm joined by FP contributor Rosa Brooks, a Georgetown University law professor who teaches international law, national security, and constitutional law. Also with me is another FP columnist, Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. Finally, we have historian Robert Kagan, a best-selling author, columnist at the Washington Post, and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. We seem to be days away from the Congress, one way or another, advancing this Iran deal into being a reality. The administration is celebrating. 100 countries have supported it. This is a big deal. In fact, many people say this is the biggest foreign policy accomplishment of the Obama administration to date, and it may be the biggest one that they ever achieve. Rosa?
I don't know. That means they can have a big cake with 100 candles on it to celebrate all these countries going along. On the one hand, I think there seems to be an irony, which is on the one hand, this doesn't seem like a big deal at all. This is just not acting stupid and not acting blind, and we shouldn't be cheering too much just because the United States of America has decided not to act as stupid as it was acting. On the other hand, given our history of doing stupid stuff, it is a big deal. I think managing to act on the recognition that our choices are unfortunately fairly limited, that we don't, however much we wish we had, have the ability to completely control what Iran does, that sometimes you have to take the least bad alternative and hope it works out and trust yet verify and all that stuff. It is an achievement. I'm not quite willing to say that this would merit the Nobel Peace Prize that Barack Obama got so many years ago. I'm not quite sure we've seen anything yet that would reach that level. That being said, it's a good thing.
Bob, in Rose's view there, this seems like the apotheosis of don't do stupid shit. The foreign policy, the core foreign policy of the Obama administration. But why is it such a big deal? Or is it, in fact, going to create more problems than it solves?
Well, first of all, we don't really know. And the whole thing about celebrating a great victory like a deal, before we know whether the deal is going to be abided by, before we know exactly what effect it's going to have, strikes me as more kind of, political and legacy building, and that's fine. But, obviously 3 or 4 years from now, we may have a different view of this. And I just think it's foolish at this moment to say, that we know what this means. As a matter of fact, like other past presidents, this president is kicking this problem to the next president. Now, I actually think he may be kicking it in a way that is beneficial to the next president, because whatever we were going to do, and I must say, I take a certain amount of issue with the stupid. The problem is a difficult problem. There are no easy answers to it. You could decide that having a nuclear Iran anytime, whether 5 years from now or 10 years from now, is going to have very negative ramifications on the Middle East and on the world in general. So then you have bad options in dealing with it. It doesn't mean you're stupid if you try to take one of those options. But in any case, if ever there was going to be a question of using military force, if that is what a future president wants to decide to do, you had to go through this step first. And what I find interesting about all this is that, people talk about the Iraq analogy. We're following the Iraq analogy to some extent. It's like 1997. And, we'll see what happens down the road. We've gotten to the point where we have an agreement. I personally think the Iranians are going to sidestep it in various ways. And then we'll be right up against the question of, are we enforcing it or are we not enforcing it, and what does that mean?
Corey?
I do think it is the major foreign policy achievement of the Obama administration, but I don't mean that as a compliment. Right? It's the dearth of other achievements that make this stand out. I don't think it's a terrific agreement, but yes, I do think we should put it into force and abide by it, for a whole host of reasons, one of which, as I share Bob's view, that if you eventually are going to need to destroy the Iranian nuclear program, my mom will feel a lot better about doing that because we attempted to stall it, to buy some time, to hope for regime change in Iran, to gather more information about what they may actually be doing. All of those kinds of
Your
things.
Mom is a reluctant Iran hawk, as they said.
That's exactly right.
She might become less
and
reluctant.
And she is my archetypical average American voter. And so, it's a bad agreement. We should put it into force. There aren't a whole bunch of good options for dealing with this. And the fact that we are this far down the road does mean we will walk away from it alone, and that's non-trivial for me.
I'm gonna stubbornly stick with stupid, because I think President Obama did put it right when he first went to Congress on this. You know, that when realistically your choices are this deal, which is not perfect by any means, full of compromises that nobody likes, or go to war.
You know,
or do nothing, which is sort of what we've been doing in some ways. So, you know, we've been doing nothing that works. We've been doing nothing that has worked, right? This deal is just accepting reality. Would I prefer to have an Iran that will never get nuclear weapons? Absolutely, you bet. You know. I don't think that that's terribly realistic with or without this deal, but with this deal, I actually think that we are more likely to have an Iran that doesn't do something crazy if they eventually get nuclear weapons.
Well, wait, let me ask you a question. Let's take that, okay? Well, you say crazy if they eventually get nuclear weapons.
That's because I'm using crazy words like crazy and stupid.
No, I understand. And look, I'm from New Jersey. That's the kind of language I understand.
The least of
but
it.
Right, yeah.
Right.
But when you think about this, let's break it down mm-hmm. into some component parts, okay? There's the nuclear non-proliferation part. There's the stopping Iran from doing crazy stuff part.
Which I care more about than the nuclear non-proliferation
right,
part.
Right, and then there's the rest of the Middle East part. So I want to take it into three mm-hmm. parts, okay? Nuclear non-proliferation. I'm going to play devil's advocate on this thing, okay? First of all, you have this deal which essentially punts on that. Essentially, mm-hmm. it knocks it down the road 10 years. It does give them the right to do some enrichment, which we don't give our other allies we've done deals with. The Emiratis don't have the right to do enrichment, that kind of thing. And it raises the possibility that, A, the Iranians have the ability to move towards a weapon in 10 years or so, and B, that if it makes enough of the people around Iran nervous in the interim, they may want to do it anyway. Okay, that's one dimension of it. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the U.S. nuclear program, which gets 5% of the defense budget or less, is underattended to and falling behind. Pakistan, which is not too far away from all of this, is moving towards 200 nuclear warheads, miniaturization, new delivery systems. Russia is modernizing its nuclear weapons system. North Korea is continuing on its bad path. And Japan, our friend, which has been kind of in the closet as a non-nuclear state, is moving out of the closet, as a near-nuclear state, is moving out of the closet and getting nearer and nearer. So if you look at the overall picture, it may be kind of crappy deal in terms of the regional proliferation issue, and we're not even paying attention to the other bigger proliferation issues, mm-hmm. and I think that looks kind of like a bleak situation. Am I wrong? Or
no, I would just add one other shoe to drop on that, which is the Saudis and Egyptians mm-hmm. have now announced a civilian nuclear cooperation agreement. So boats are rocking, but because people are concerned about it. I agree with Bob that we don't yet know a bunch of stuff, but we can see boats rocking because people are nervous that this is actually going to embolden Iran in all sorts of ways, not just on the nuclear portfolio, but on the regional hegemony.
And doesn't it, Bob, create the situation that take the Saudis and the Egyptians, they look at this deal and say, hey, if they get to do it, we get to do it. Whatever this deal is, this sets the new line for what is possible. They get to enrich, we get to enrich. If they get to do what they're doing in terms of missile delivery, we get to do what they're doing in terms of missile. Isn't that problematic too?
Yeah, of course it's problematic. And I don't know what capacity we have to stop them from doing that or to convince them not to do it, and I'm sure we'll make that effort. We have successfully gotten other nations like Japan not to go in that direction, even though they can face a bigger threat than Iran does and bigger threat than Saudi does. But look, at the end of the day, I mean, where I agree with Rosa is we have never, ever stopped a hostile power from getting a nuclear weapon. We have stopped our allies from getting nuclear weapons. We have stopped countries that are basically under our security umbrella from getting a weapon. We have never successfully prevented it. So I don't know that there was ever a means of stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. That having been said, are we better off having made this deal or having continued along the path that we're already on, which is using sanctions to get them to give up their program, knowing that that may or may not happen? Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me, for all the reasons that you just raised, that we haven't in some ways made things worse by having a kind of faux agreement where, you know, at the end of the day, they're still going to get a nuclear weapon. And then the question, but I think much more importantly, and it gets to, you know, Rose's initial, you know, what are the choices? This is Obama said. Now, one of the things that I find interesting about this, well, what did you think? It was going to be either this or war. Obama spent the first X number of years of his presidency saying, if Iran refuses to stop its program of developing a nuclear weapon, I will use force. And I don't know how many times I was reassured by every single administration official, boy, he absolutely means it. So at one time, at least, he thought that one plausible alternative was using force. Now to even talk about using force, you're obviously a raving lunatic. You got us into Iraq and all this kind of stuff.
I was just going to say you're clearly a raving lunatic.
Well, everybody knows. Didn't he tiptoe around it a little bit more with the sort of the usual formulation of, you know, no options are off the table?
No. Because if you, and I'm sure you know as well as I do, I've sat in the room. I won't name the officials because they were off the record officials, but they said, you know what? That isn't just language. He really means it. And I must say, a lot of people, and I don't think anybody ever convinced you, David, but a lot of people were convinced, you know, I think he really does mean it because this is that serious an issue for him. He doesn't want to leave office with having left that legacy behind him. Okay, fine. And he turns out he didn't really mean it. But to now say that even talking about war is like unthinkable, it just seems like it's a little bit of... Well, it's a political leisure demand, you know?
It's doubly problematic because another thing he says is, if you didn't have this deal, they'd have a nuclear weapon in 3 months. Well, no, they wouldn't if you actually meant you would stop them by taking military action.
He wants to earn his Nobel Peace Prize, though, Bob.
I thought his speech earned him the prize. He gave a great speech when he won that prize, which made it good enough for me.
That was the Nobel Speech Prize.
The Nobel Speech Prize. Yeah, but I got to tell you, when I read the Nobel, to digress, when you read his speech about the necessity of American military power in holding the world order together, and then you hear, you know, we have another way, you know, we're for peace, not for the... And it's like, which Obama is it? And to me, this is always a very interesting question with presidents, because you never really know what's in these... what's really in his head?
Well, and I think to add, I mean, David, you were sort of saying, let's disaggregate this. Let's you know, have the Iran proliferation piece and then the Iran crazy stuff piece, which is at least potentially separable from the proliferation piece, and then the broader effects on the region. We could add another whole category here, which is the politics of this and what does Obama think he in fact is doing, and does he care that there? I think you're absolutely right, Bob. Are there contradictions in Obama's rhetoric over the years about this? You bet. Is that because he's changed his mind? Is that because his thought is contradictory? Or is that because he's being, frankly, just a Machiavellian politician and will say what he thinks he has to say at any given moment? I'm sort of going to go with that one.
Which would not make him unlike many other presidents in history.
But. Well, he may actually feel, you know, I deeply believe everything I'm saying and be Machiavellian. They're not mutually exclusive.
Well, people tend to believe what is useful for them to believe.
Right. Yeah. No, it helps. It helps one wake up in the morning and go to work. You know. But let's shift it over a second, okay? Let's shift it to the Iran doing crazy stuff component of this thing. The argument goes: here is Iran, and it's going to get $150 billion. The administration will say $56 billion. There are other people who say $200 billion. Some people say, but, you know, then there's $20 billion a year of oil revenue. They're going to get a lot of money that they didn't have before. So that's going to be a big thing. And that's going to enable them to take some of that money and go and fund terror, which they've been doing as the number one state sponsor of terror. Back up bad guys in the region like Assad, which they've been doing, spending tens of billions of dollars even while they were under sanctions backing this guy up. The case gets a little bit worse, actually, though, because what else is going to happen? Tens of thousands of business people from around the world are going to go to Iran and they're going to go and cut deals. And then they're going to go home and they're going to say, you know what? I got a deal in Iran. So let's not screw around with these guys because I'm now invested in this place, you know? And so all of a sudden, Iran's going to get a political cadre in key markets around the world as an advocate, which they didn't have before. So all of this gives them resources and political cover, and it enables them to continue to exacerbate a growing imbalance between their power in the region, they've been gaining the past few years, and the power of our traditional allies in the region, Sunni Arab states, Gulf states, Jordan, the Israelis, who have all been weakened for one reason or another for the past few years. And so in some ways, we have our thumb on the scale, but it's not the side of the scale that everybody thought we'd have. Is that?
Yeah, it looks the same to me, David, that unquestionably the initial beneficiaries of the lifting of sanctions are going to be people in the Iranian government, close to the Iranian government, the IRGC, the establishment, who have been keeping Assad in power, who have been funding Hezbollah and Hamas, and training and staffing, too, by the way. So it seems to me that our best strategy, if the deal goes in place, is to blast past that as fast as possible and make them not be the only beneficiaries of the agreement, because it's certainly true that you will have cadres of people in the West who then have a reason to want Iran to be successful. But the flip side is also true, right? There will be Iranians mm-hmm. who have links with the West, who don't want to be seen as the funder of Hezbollah and Hamas, who don't want to be associated with Assad. So getting through the narrow passage and getting out into broader Iranian society seems to be one of the best ways we can help mm-hmm. put the deal into effect in a way that's not damaging.
Look, the hardest thing to do is to determine the internal decision-making of another country, especially a hostile one. So when we set ourselves up the task of preventing them from having a nuclear weapon, we basically chose the hardest possible thing to do. What is easier to do, although it's easy certainly theoretically and it may be costly, is to contain a power like Iran in a region. And I think that we have the capacity, I don't think we have the will at the moment, but we have the capacity to contain even Iran's growing power. I mean, at the end of the day, we are, I would say, successfully containing China. We can successfully contain Russia. I don't think $100 billion means the difference between our successful containment or lack thereof. It's really up to us, it seems to me, what Iran is able to do in the region. Now, that means, you know, we have allowed, it's not just that they're propping up Assad, we've been propping up Assad de facto.
Shh, you're not supposed to say that.
De facto, no, because they're, anyway, well, I
don't, that's
I
don't tell anyone.
I want, you know?
Yeah.
I don't work in the government, thank God. But, you know, we have treated them as a de facto ally against Al-Qaeda and now ISIS. And
both of them, Assad and Iran.
Right. Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Which one is not our ally?
I don't think we have treated Iran as our ally, even de facto.
We're flying air support for them in Iraq. I mean, how are you more of an ally than if you're actually flying air support
well,
for it?
This gets me to my larger point. This gets me to my next point. There is the question of containing Iran, but then there is also the, I would say, much broader question of what is it exactly that we want in the Middle
mm-hmm,
East?
Mm-hmm.
We now talk about our traditional allies. I must say, I don't know who they are at this point. I'm not sure these are real allies. You know, I am not, whatever else is the case, I am not going to stake American power and prestige on the success of the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or al-Sisi's Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, that is just a losing course, it seems to me. Now, that doesn't mean I want to abandon them or either, but a policy that is now built around this alliance that Israel has created with these folks, that just doesn't strike me as the right route to the future.
Well, but let's answer the question.
And it's really a substitute for us using our own influence and
yes.
power in the region. Now, I understand that the mood of the country is that they would like the entire region all to go kill themselves. And I think that's Obama's view, too, if you really, in the deepest recesses, he would say, the nice way of putting it is, they're going to be having this fight. There's nothing we can do about it. Let's wait for it to burn itself out, and we'll see what happens. I mean, I think that's the sort of polite way of putting it. But I don't know, other than sort of trying to contain Iran, what our strategy is supposed to be in the region.
Well, I mean, I think you ask a big question. What do we want? What does America want in this region? And you have to know that to have a strategy. I don't think anybody knows that, which means we don't have a strategy. And I think that's one of our biggest problems, is that we're reacting to the problem of the moment, whether it was Bush reacting to 9/11 or it's Obama reacting to Bush. It's still not a strategy.
Well, I think we could know. We just don't even want to. We don't even want to formulate a strategy. I think there's a strategy to be had in the region.
Go ahead.
I think that the only vision that we can support in the region is one where ultimately these different sectarian groups come back to being at peace with each other and living with each other in some acceptable fashion. And the only way that's going to happen, it seems to me, is if yes, I hate to say this, if you actually do push for more open, liberal, and in some cases, democratic societies. Now, what that means is Iraq is still salvageable, in my opinion.
I agree.
And Iraq is not something that we should give up on. We actually had conducted an experiment which had its up moments and its down moments, but it is not consigned to oblivion, as far as I'm concerned, as far as endless sectarian warfare, if we are willing to do what needs to be done there. I think that we have made a mistake in Libya. We made the mistake immediately after departing that we didn't put in, you know, if this were the 1990s, we would have sent an international peacekeeping force into Libya and stayed there, just like we did in the Balkans, just like we did in other parts of the world. Libya is a place that we should still try to work on salvaging. And then, of course, there is Syria, where we, I think, need to have a policy that gets rid of Assad and then opens up the system so that people, including the Shia in Syria, can feel like they're safe. These are big undertakings, and the reason nobody wants to talk about a strategy like this is because it's a big commitment. But I think the idea that we are simply now going to rely on people like Sisi to defend us in the region, I think that's a big mistake.
Isn't Bob really just a misty-eyed romantic? I mean, the notion of democracy taking root in the Middle East, we talk about this all the time. Is that really a reasonable goal for us to set?
Yes, it is. It
depends on your time span.
Well, let's see.
5 years, no. If it's 500, sure.
No, in 500 years, somewhere between 5 and 500 years, I'm willing.
I think we should separate the two concepts of failures of governance and democracy as a form of governance. What I thought I heard Bob saying is that this is a crisis of governance. These don't necessarily need to be near-term democracies, but they need to be led by people who are inclusive, who are open, where you have the rule of law. In my judgment, that inevitably takes us.
I give you a gold star, A+ on that, because I think that's the switch in the vocabulary that works for me. If you go and say governance, we need better governance. We need to create more opportunity. We need.
I know, but what does that actually mean? Look,
right.
I mean these are nice, and I don't disagree with them. But to me, that always feels like it's a way of not saying democracy. Yeah. But here's why democracy. Here's why, you know, when people. Contrary to what people think, George Bush didn't invade Iraq in order to promote democracy. That is absolutely, was an ex post facto justification. You know, I don't know what Paul Wolfowitz wanted to do, but that was not the reason. However, once you are in a place like Iraq and you're facing a Sunni, Shia, Kurd, conflict, the only way to settle that is to give them some kind of representation in government that they feel is legitimate. And I think that there's no answer in Syria that doesn't include making sure that each of the sectarian groups feels like it is represented. What strongman is going to do that for you?
See, I'm going to give all of you two gold stars, because that sounds great, and I agree with all of that, but here's the big but. I have really gone 180 degrees on this stuff in the last decade myself. I have no faith, maybe, you never know. But I have no faith in our meaning the U.S., our ability to control the situation at all. And I say this both looking at U.S. foreign policy over the last 15 years and as an academic who studies rule of law promotion efforts and democracy promotion efforts, we don't know what we're doing. The international community does not know what it's doing. There is virtually no evidence-based approach to making a difference. And there's a World Bank report that came out a few years back that looked at the time it took for sort of worst performing states on a variety of measures, rule of law and governance related measures, to sort of cross the line to, you know, not complete basket case states. And for things like rule of law and democratization, the short time periods were like 40 or 50 years. So that's not an argument for saying walk away, wash your hands, say either let them all kill each other or gee, we sure hope they don't kill each other, but either way, bye-bye, guys, see ya. You know, it's not an argument for not using foreign assistance to the best of our ability to attempt to incentivize what we want. But I think, it to me, we can't, I mean, you used the word, and I don't mean to pick on this one word because I know you're just saying it casually. You say we have to give them certain kinds of governance alternatives, but we can't give them anything. You know, we don't have the ability.
I'm going to push back.
Of course.
I know this is what's become. I mean, this is where we are now. What you just said is where we are.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, it's healthy to move from excessive optimism about what we can do, but it's not healthy if it's to excessive pessimism. And I don't even read the history the way you do.
But
I mean,
when you're pessimistic, then you're always pleasantly surprised.
No, if not if your pessimism leads you not to try to do anything.
And you try, but it depends what you try, right?
No, but I mean, look, we are invariably, and this is something I think Ben Rhodes doesn't seem to understand based on what I saw of his interview in the New York Times magazine, we are invariably a player in all these systems. We are too powerful not to be. We have a history of involvement. We have a history of exercising our power. Whether we do or do not exercise our power has an impact on the society. So let's not kid ourselves
that
by pulling
enough.
Out, we are somehow engaged in a neutral activity.
And
this is what's happened. And most of the time, I agree with you, long-term nation building, rule of law, that kind of stuff, that's not really how it works. What happens is when you act in a certain way at critical moments in those countries' history. So, for instance, South Korea reached a critical moment at the end of the 1980s. The United States pulled the rug out from under, told the junta to get lost, and then you had a pretty well-established democracy in Korea. Same story in the Philippines. Same story in several Latin American countries where at the critical moment when the test came, the United States played a critical role. Egypt is a place where I feel like Egypt reached that point, and we failed to play the critical role, and now Egypt has sunk back into a very bad direction. So I'm not talking about this long term. Iraq, we invaded, as always is the case, we invade countries for one reason, then we have to wind up doing something about it. When we invaded Iraq for the weapons of mass destruction, we nevertheless were in a position to do something for Iraq, which I think could have worked, but would it have required a very long, sustained involvement on our part? Absolutely. The question is, what is the alternative? And if you can tell me that the alternative to this is a cost, it's never going to come back to bite us, then I could say, okay, I get your point. I'm just not so sure that these things don't come back to bite us.
You never know. I mean, I think this was your first point, of course, is that our ability to predict what other governments and other populations are going to do and want is very limited. They're limited partly for the very obvious reasons that we don't have the linguistic and cultural skills for the most part, but also just because they're extremely complex systems. We don't know what's going to happen in this country, much less another country. And we do speak the language, but I think it partly does just go to how ambitious we are. And your point that there's no neutral action, including turning our backs, is very well taken. But I'm enough of an optimist, going back to the original Iran question, to think, you know, to me, part of the value of the deal is that while it doesn't by any stretch of the imagination guarantee that Iran doesn't do something crazy, it somewhat reduces their incentive to act crazy and increases their incentive precisely because we ideally get more business ties with Europe, with the United States over time, more travel and so on. It slightly reduces their incentive to act crazy because they don't need to act crazy anymore in order to get the stuff that they want. But I think that I wouldn't necessarily go from that to I mean, we'd have to get into specifics about our ability to affect outcomes in a way that we can predict in places like Syria, in places like Egypt, in places like Libya, in places like Iraq.
In a second, we're going to have to wrap up this section of this discussion, although the whole idea here is that this is an ongoing conversation that we have week to week. But I want to give Corey the last word on this. You've just heard a kind of an optimistic vision of where this deal leaves us. And it's a vision that sort of says they are disincented from acting crazy as a consequence. Is there a counterargument?
There is a counterargument, but there's also a contradiction in what Rosa's saying, right? Which is that we don't have an ability to influence any other country.
I embrace multitudes, Corey.
We don't have the ability to affect another country, but this deal is going to affect Iran's development.
We don't have the ability to affect them in ways that we can predict and control.
Who says we predict and control stuff? It's like small ball in baseball, right? Mm-hmm. Like the lead runner walks, you steal second, a sacrifice fly takes him to third, and then a suicide squeeze brings him home. There are lots of stuff
we
can do.
Do I hear you embracing lead from
behind?
No suicide squeeze and four balls. Okay. There's the doctrine. There's the Kagan doctrine. Suicide squeezes in foreign policy.
Well, but, I mean, it's an interesting corollary to the Obama doctrine of singles and doubles, right?
No, it is the Obama doctrine of singles and doubles. Sounds like.
I would differ. But yes, to answer your question, there is a potential downside, which is the argument that opening up trade and opportunity and engagement is actually going to foster change in Iran actually is a starry-eyed, optimistic, democratic argument that may not prove true.
Can I just add one point, or is it?
This is the last point of this segment.
I think it's just a mistake analytically to talk about them doing crazy stuff. Iran is going to continue to have fundamentally the same interests it had before, after the deal, that it had before the deal. I don't expect its interests to fundamentally change, even if there is greater engagement with the world. And its interests include exercising a certain level of hegemony in the Middle East. Whether they do that or not, in my opinion, is going to be shaped by our response to that effort, not by any internal change on their part.
Okay, good. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. Our panelists have been Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University, Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and Bob Kagan of Brookings. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe, please visit foreignpolicy.com. Thank you for joining us.